Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Thursday, the 9th of May, and coming up on our program, Shell's departure and the impact on forecourts and jobs. The George building tragedy, as the chances of finding more survivors is now slim. There is new thinking on South Africa's NHI. Should we all go private? Our accelerating obesity problem, a policy or a cost issue, and the not-so-bright future of cinema in South Africa. Let's start with this, and overnight Shell has said it's agreed to sell its refinery and petrochemical assets in Singapore, Asia's main oil hub, to a joint venture between Indonesian chemical firms Chandra Asri and the Swiss miner and commodities trader Glencore. All of this is part of a wider global disposal strategy, including South Africa. But locally, the question remains, what impact is this going to have on local service stations and jobs? Liquid Fuels Wholesalers Association of South Africa Chief Executive Officer Peter Morgan is with us now and starts the program. Peter, welcome to you. And have you been expecting this?
Yes, we have. And why do we say that? It's because Chevron have already sold to Glencore. And we saw a new brand called Astron come in. We've seen the announcement that the deal with Vitol and Engen has been approved by the Competitions Commission. We've heard rumors of BP, you know, looking to sell their retail networks, and they have a buyer in Dubai, but we yet can't find out who that is. So when that happens and the refineries are closed and not opening again and they're becoming import terminals, then the whole business model shifts. And I think that's where we are now.
What impact then is this going to have on your constituency?
You know, there's a bigger picture. If we ask ourselves, why is Shell doing this? And then we ask ourselves the same question about our members, it's probably the same answer. Why is Shell doing this? We know that companies invest in businesses, do business and stay in business when the return and risk profile is worth their while. And if we look at this industry from the late 50s, when we built our refineries to now, the shareholder expectation and the shareholder realization has changed drastically. In fact, I got a slide from the department a number of years ago that really had two maps of Africa. And the one was in 2004 on the left-hand side of the slide, and it was predominantly dark blue with a few gray spots. Dark blue meant the oil industry trading as themselves in Africa. The second part of the slide is 2014, and it's the reverse. It's gray with a few dark blobs and the sort of the southern tip of Africa being dark, being South Africa. So I believe that the guys have been leaving Africa, moving out of the oil majors are moving out of retail in Africa for years now. Because effectively what they're telling us, if you read Shell's statement, is they will take the same money and go upstream and make a lot more return for their investors than they can in the retail side of the business.
So, Peter, if this is happening then, if it's a trend regarding all the oil majors and if the trajectory continues, where does this leave this country in terms of supply?
Well, security of supply is critical. I mean, that's why you build the refineries in the first place. So what we're finding is that the traders come in behind the oil companies. And if I look at Shell, they have left a number of countries in Africa, the retail downstream. What they do is they bring a secondary brand in behind it, still own 20% of that company and find another investor for the 80%. So with the 60s, 70s, 80s, that thing we had called Empire, the Empire created an environment by the government of the day that encouraged people to come and invest here. And people did. I mean, we have some of the best retail networks globally if you look at what you know, 60s, 70s and 80s. We're still building superb service stations. I think in many cases far too good, but that's a completely different argument. Mm. So if I look at what happened, and for me, it's a very real example. 100 meters from me, there's used to be a Chevron service station, and it was looking pretty tired. Before the end of last year, Astron came and rebranded it. Orange and purple, new lights, new shop, new cashier's uniforms, new pump attendants' uniforms. The energy level on that site just went up overnight. It's a different place to go and get fuel now than it used to be. It's a happy, smiley place. So we may have to get used to new brands, but I think the issue about security of supply is more about the harbors and the ports being able to handle all the vessels coming in. Because, you know, the difference between the traders, which is what we're talking about now, you know, Glencore, Trafigura with Puma, Vitol with Engine, it's very possible that Shell come with a trader, you know, as their new partner for exactly the same reason. There is one big difference between oil companies and traders. Oil companies were really into long-term relationships and long-term investments. And if you're building a service station or if you're building a refinery, these are 25-year investments before you, you know, that's the number you start looking at before you even look at the spend on the retail side. Traders are slightly different. I mean, what does a trader do? They sit between the guy who's got the product and the customer, being us in the market. And their role is to get the best deal that they can from the supplier and then get the best deal that they can from the customer and make the most money that they can for their shareholders. Any concern I have is that if you look at those two, I don't know, we don't know yet, and it's perhaps unfair to say this, but we don't know yet whether that, you know, they're going to be conducive to the long-term relationships that we've been used to, that we'd like to have because of the amounts of money and the long investment terms that service stations in our industry have.
Peter Morgan, given the concerning picture that you're painting, though, why would traders want to become involved in this, given what I can only assume is increasing risk here?
You know, traders will make a lot of money out of us. That's really why they're here. Traders make a lot of money wherever they go, for whatever reason they go. That's the nature of their business. It may mean we'll pay more for the product in the future. Mm. That's the only risk.
That was my next question. Mm. What about Shell's locations? Are they attractive to traders once this happens?
You know, I actually worked for Shell for 25 years. I'm really convinced in my own mind that they've been looking at this situation that we're talking about now for a long, long time. And I'm pretty sure that they've already done the deal, and all they're doing is giving us a warning to say, hey, guys, this is happening. They have a very good network. I don't believe there's only one guy that Shell's talking to. I think there must be a number of people globally who are saying, hey, we actually like your network. We're quite happy to come and talk to you about taking a vast share of that over. Of course, if you're a trader and you've got, it's almost like a shopping center, you've got an anchor customer who is your own network, then you've got the best of both worlds. You can control that and then off the back of that, you know, talk to all the other purchasers in the country and see if you can't grow your market share once you've done that.
Peter Morgan, thank you very much for talking to me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The debate around the feasibility of South Africa's national health insurance plan that government is currently pushing into law is continuing, and now economist Davie Ruit has presented an alternative vision that calls for the entire health industry to be privatized. Is there any merit in this? He joins me now, and Davie Ruit, welcome. So what led you to propose full privatization?
What has led me to this, Jeremy? Quite easy. If you look at what's been happening in South Africa to electricity, what's been happening to infrastructure, what's been happening to education in South Africa, what's been happening since the ANC has been in charge in South Africa, especially the past 15 years, then I'm very sure that the NHI, if it is ever implemented, and I don't think it will be implemented, will be a disaster as well. At the same time, during the same time, if you look, for example, at education, you will find that the private sector is doing an excellent job. The private sector health services are really good in South Africa. The private sector is even taking over Eskom. The private sector is taking over the post office. So clearly the private sector is doing a much, much better job. The NHI, like I've said, is not going to become a reality in South Africa for a number of reasons. One is there simply isn't enough money. But secondly, I think this is going to be bogged down in the courts forever. It's probably unconstitutional as it is. And the third reason, and the most important reason, is that we simply do not have a government with the capacity to do this. So why don't we use the private sector? Why don't we privatize everything and get everybody to make use of private sector? medical services, and I don't think it's going to be that difficult to do.
Davi Rutt, your detractors might turn around and say that if it falls into private hands, it will concomitantly become more expensive.
Well, that's another point, but if it's free, it is much more expensive than when it is in private hands, as an example. Well, let me just give you some numbers, or maybe just make a few comments, which is important. We spend huge amounts of money in South Africa on health services. That's the private sector and the state. So why don't we simply channel the money of the state to the private sector? We get, for example, my proposal will be to use the Department of Health and break it up into three major pieces or three small parts and call them each a pension, or rather a medical fund. So everybody in South Africa must belong to a medical fund. And if you don't belong to a medical fund, then become a member of one of these state medical funds, as an example, and treat it exactly the same as a normal private sector medical fund. And what you also need to do is that you have to privatize the medical facilities like hospitals and clinics. You can even give it away to the people that work there. And then from now on, they have to run it like a normal business. And in the process, everybody will be getting much better medical services. And in the process, I think it will even become profitable as well. There will be many, many business opportunities in medicine, generally speaking, in the country then as well.
David Roth, where would you see the downside here? Where are the risks? Because every flip or change like this would carry risk, wouldn't it?
Yeah, there's one major risk, and that is that if I get a, say, let's call it a state medical fund, of course there are unlimited resources. So if I've got a major operation, for example, and I've used all my benefits on my medical fund, my state-sponsored medical fund, for example, then if I get a heart attack or something serious happens to me, then nobody will be able to look after me, unlike what we have currently. So currently, you do not have a limited medical fund. You have to go to you can go to a hospital and you will be treated. Not well treated, but you will be treated in a state hospital. So that is a major problem that I do see. But my answer to that is that if you run out of medical benefits because you've been sick and you've used all your medical benefits in a certain period, then you have to. It will be compulsory for you if you want to get medical services to go to a university hospital, as an example, and allow students to, well, let's use the word practice on you, because that is exactly what is happening at the moment. If you go to universities or university hospitals, students, medical students, will look after you, under supervision of a senior medical person. But that's a price, in inverted commas, that you will have to pay if you run out of medical benefits. You have to go to a university medical facility to be treated.
Davi, you've obviously applied your mind carefully to this. I wonder if there are successful examples from other countries with a fully privatized healthcare system.
I anticipated this question, Jeremy, and the answer is no, I don't know of one. But I do know of many countries in the world that run state-run medical services, and I know of many countries in the world that run education systems, and they're quite successful with that. I know of many countries in the world, governments in the world, that run electricity, and they're quite successful at that. So there are many examples where the opposite is true. But the reality is none of those examples apply to South Africa. In South Africa, we do not have a government that runs electricity well, or education well, or health services. But we do have a private sector that's very well, doing very well at all of those. So although I do not know for an example internationally, I know of many examples in South Africa where the private sector is doing a much better job than the state. And maybe I should just add something else, Jeremy, and this is also important. If you look at the private sector medical industry in South Africa, remember economic laws apply to everything, not only to trade or to manufacturing. It also applies to the medical industry as well. And I think the medical industry in South Africa is far too protected. I think the quality, we're trying to achieve far too high a quality. And I think we have to reduce the barriers to entry in the private sector medical industry as well. So for example, it's extremely difficult to become a dermatologist. You have to get a normal medical degree and then you have to go and specialize. I think there must be a shorter way to becoming a dermatologist. I also believe that a normal qualified sister should be allowed to prescribe antibiotics, as an example. Why do you have to be a doctor to prescribe antibiotics? Those kind of examples. So we have to make it easier for more private sector competition as well.
Davi Rutt, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's stay on a health theme. And my next guest says South Africa has undergone a nutritional transition over the past three decades, characterized by what he terms the triple burden of malnutrition. In other words, households simultaneously experiencing undernutrition, hidden hunger, and overweight or obesity due to poor nutrient diets. Professor Thokozani Semelani is with the Human Sciences Research Council. And first of all, Professor, welcome. And can you elaborate firstly then what you mean by this nutritional transition?
No problem, Jeremy. And normally when I make that reference, I draw to the attention of the readers and the audience that since 1994, in South Africa, we were having various food systems, or maybe I can refer to them as subsystems, some that were located within the self-governing states, and some, of course, that were located within the TPVC states, and the one that were primarily within what we can refer to as Old South Africa. The dietary composition, as per what people were cultivating and eating in the household, was reflective of the cultural diversity that was in the country. After 1994, the food system was then combined and assumed to be now fitting within the new South Africa. So the practices of producing and cultivating certain specific types of food which were eaten in the household diminished. The land that was used for cultivating those types of foods also now ended up being used for settlement. That's a kind of transitioning that I'm referring to.
Professor, do you think that this is a cost issue or a policy issue or a combination of both?
Primarily, it's a policy issue. Policy issue in the sense that what actually happened within, mainly from the perspective or the practice of the Department of Agriculture, is that they developed the programs that were intended to improve or sustain food security at a household level. But those programs turned up to be one size fit all, as per the assumptions. They never improved or promote the sustenance or the cultivation of the diverse nature of food that will to be produced. This is despite the fact that heterogeneity or diversity in food systems is critical. You know, what you are eating in your household might differ considerably from what I'm eating in my household. But now what is happening is that the major sources of food for household ended up being supermarkets. And supermarkets, as you may be aware, they get their food from the industrial producers, which promotes monoculture. So I would say it's a policy issue on that regard. Hence then, coming to the issue of income or financial issues, I would say so. The only way which now households find themselves being a way of accessing food in the household is that they must have to buy it from the supermarket. So the income is a critical issue, and income is always scarce.
Professor, you've made a number of recommendations based on your work. I'm wondering which of these you believe would have the most immediate impact on improving food security and nutrition.
The good thing is that the project itself is a project of the Department of Agriculture, Land Reform and Rural Development. It started as a way of the department wanting actually to understand the severity of food insecurity and nutrition at a household level. So the recommendations that are there are not necessarily my recommendations, but the recommendations that have been put forward to the national department as well as the provincial departments of agriculture, land reform, and rural development. As such, the departments themselves in all, I would say, two strata of government operations, firstly have acknowledged the fact that there are areas or districts that they need to prioritize with an intention of improving the state of food security and nutrition in households. They are now appreciating the fact that the one size fit all is not an ideal approach which they will have to follow moving forward. So I can say the immediate impact of this survey and the recommendations that are being made is that they have been absorbed and infused into the operations and the practice of the government with regards to the programs that are going to be developed past 30 years. That's a fortunate part of this.
Right. But Professor, you will agree with me, though, that given the rate of increase in obesity, time here is of the essence. It's running out. Are you confident that we can turn this around quick enough to arrest the problem as it exists at the moment?
I would rather say probably yes. I don't want to say certainly so. Probably yes, in the sense that you are correct when you say that obesity is on the rise. And it seems as if we are running against time, because the number of people who are now suffering from the communicable diseases has increased also considerably. But one thing for sure I believe on is that education touches everyone. So I would rather say that is the time to intensify education on the importance of eating healthy, although what I'm saying might have limits. Limits in the sense that in actual fact, people eat unhealthy, not because there is a variety of choices. They don't have a choice. The main determinant of what people or household or is eating in the household actually is the income. Mm. So in a country that is experiencing the high unemployment rate and really unreliable or unsustainable, that's a strong word, I don't want to use that, economic system, we have no choice that we or hope that we can improve or change what is being eaten in the household. Hence, I believe and I think that education is important, so that also people can be motivated to produce their own food. That would be a short-term intervention at the moment.
I am going to leave it there. Professor Tokozani Simelane, thank you very much indeed from the Human Sciences Research Council. I appreciate it.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Heroic stories of survival as well as aid are starting to emerge now from the George building collapse. The death toll, we understand, is 844 people still unaccounted for. On the program yesterday, we spoke about the process moving from rescue to recovery. And one organization front and center and helping out is the Gift of the Givers. The founder, Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman, is with me now. Dr. Suleiman, welcome to you. So what does the situation look like right now? And I assume that the chances of finding more survivors is becoming increasingly slim.
Good afternoon. You're excellent as I, Jeremy. It's 72 hours in the next 2 hours or so. I don't actually follow the 72-hour limit, you know, or international norm, because we've seen people come out of rubble later than that. We've got personal experience twice. Once in Haiti on day 8, we took a person out on the 20th of January 2010. It was day 8. But it was a collapsed Catholic church. It wasn't a five-story building. But at the same time, in Turkey, on the 13th of February last year, we pulled out a 90-year-old lady on day 8 in a 12-story collapsed building. Here, what's different is that it was a very sudden collapse. It was pancaked. And the problem is it was 3,000 tons of concrete that fell with a rapid force very suddenly. And even though people were taken out alive, they were severely, severely injured. And 16 of them have been critically ill. That's the first problem. The second thing is, what every hour, the dogs can't pick up any more live scent.
Dr. Suleiman,
They've been picking up scent of deceased people even now today. They've been picking up more scent of deceased people. And the third thing is, the survivors who came out said there were a lot of bodies around where they were. Mm.
Rescue and recovery is also, you'll tell me, a time-consuming and a dangerous job. Explain that to me, given your past experience at other disaster zones.
The structural engineers were here, and from day one, they were worried that this building was very, very unstable. And quite often, whilst they were working, they said, look, the floors are moving, the concrete is moving. It's high risk for the rescue workers. And there was a professor, Richard Walls, here. Apparently, he's one of the best structural engineers in the world when it comes to structural destruction in disasters. And in between, he would stop the people and say, no, you can't do this. You've got to drill here. You've got to change. You've got to fill the rubble there. You know, it was all engineering things. And you could see they were taking all the precautions. The biggest challenge is that there was 5 floors. And the people who survived in the basement. It looks like there was a gap there. So you had to go into the basement to take people out. And it's deceptive, not only in the basement, but somewhere else where they took the people out. When they saw one of the survivors, they thought they'll have the survivor out in an hour or two. It took 2 days to take the person out. It was complicated. And right now, the whole of last night, they were preparing the building to move heavy demolition equipment in. They're expecting the demolition equipment to come in soon. And in essence, you know what, with the high risk, unstable building, the chances the dogs are not picking up any life scent, and the fact that it's 3,000 tons of concrete that fell so strongly on people so rapidly, it's basically in a recovery phase now.
Dr. Suleiman, impact both psychologically and physically on the rescue workers themselves must be enormous.
Well, you can see they're exhausted. You can see the energy levels are dropping. It's standard procedure. You know, the positive side of it is it's very well supported. I've never seen a site, but we haven't had this kind of a building collapse, you know, anywhere in the country. Mm. Yes, we've had people involved in the floods in KZN in 2022, people on the site of a fire. But I think what has kept spirits up and adrenaline pumping is that the first 24 hours, you know, 36 people were taken out. So yes, arguably 7 were deceased, and you know, the others lived, although they were severely injured. But the vibe, people from all over here encouraging each other, there's, you know, community members coming, a T10 set up, the whole street full of lights, trucks, equipment, everybody supporting everybody. And as 24 and 48 and 70 hours started coming, people started getting tired, losing, you know, courage. Now there's no more life sent, disease, but we can't get to them. There's so much of concrete. So that's the first thing. I don't think they've suffered so much of emotional trauma, because you've only taken out, you know, 7 deceased people. And it's normally when you haven't seen family members around you. You know, there are family members, but not in large volumes like an earthquake, like in Turkey, where hundreds of people are standing on the side of the street and each one tugging at you, come to this building, come to this building, come to this building. My father is here, my daughter is here, my son is here, my family is here. Here the people are sitting separately in a different hall, waiting patiently and quietly for people to come, you know, and come give them some news. Secondly, most of them are foreign nationals. So even if they got pain and suffering, you can't understand them because their language is different, you know, and they're not on site directly. So I don't think that has impacted negatively psychologically on the people themselves. It has impacted, of course, on the family members. Well, I now hear us saying, don't sign a petition to say, please don't say it's rescue. Still, you know, it's still don't say it's recovery. Say it's still rescue, and don't call it in the end. You know, at the end of 72 hours, you must try still for rescue. So, and the other thing I think that we have missed out is there's a building right next door to this building that collapsed, and I'm not sure what the impact was on those people who are not in the building, but were next to the building. And, you know, and it came down to such a force, with such a loud sound. I'm not sure if they heard anybody screaming or shouting or crying and what shock waves they went through. They have still to be accessed to see if they need any trauma counseling.
Well, the images, Dr. Suleiman, that you paint are absolutely heart-wrenching. Thank you very much for joining us today, founder of the aid organization Gift of the Givers.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Let me finish the program on a slightly happier note today, and cinema chain Ster-Kinekor has come up with a clever idea, screening of what are termed throwback titles, and I also read at a throwback cost as well. But I'm going to ask the question, is this just a clever marketing gimmick, given that the chain announced 3 weeks ago that it was cutting back on staff and also closing some cinemas? Mark Sadi is the chief executive officer of Ster-Kinekor. Mark, welcome to you. So what has driven this throwback idea then?
So, Jeremy, a number of things. I think, you know, given the recent challenges that I think you laid out at the beginning of your introduction there, we're starting to relook at the way we portray value versus price. You know, the good old Oscar Wilde, everyone knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. I think cinema needs to do a bit more in that regard. And one of the ways to manage through this writers and actors strike where the content has been pushed out to either early next year or later this year is to look at a catalogue and remind people of the majesty of cinema. And to say that, you know, we're here, you know, cinema is one of these very interesting businesses which has survived a significant technological disruption event through streaming, survived through COVID, but has had some sort of near-term headwinds that we need to, you know, obviously meet head-on. And this is one of the ways that we think we can remind people of that that format.
I imagine your biggest challenge going forward is to find new audiences and to give them an experience that I guess goes beyond the traditional popcorn experience. People are spending a lot of money going out. They would look for added value, no doubt.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, the way we've tried to come at that in some way is through our multi-format offering. We've got 9 IMAX cinemas. Now, I don't know if you ever watched either Dune or Oppenheimer. To watch it in an environment where it's been shot with IMAX cameras is something that is, you know, you won't experience anywhere else. We have what I call the business class offering through Prestige with recliner seats and the ability to have food and beverage brought directly to you. We've got a kids offering, which allows the kids to go and cause mayhem on the side while you and your significant other enjoy time in the space. And we have this thing that moves you all over the place called D-Box inside the theater. So I think it's our job to remind people that it's there. And I also think repurposing some of our cinemas during the week for other things and collaborating with other forms of entertainment is going to be important as we, you know, walk through this journey of reminding people about cinema again.
It's always about cost eventually, though. It can be an expensive night out for a family of four.
It can be. And, you know, we often benchmark ourselves against, you know, if eating out was all about price and convenience, then no one would have, you know, go to restaurants. I think this concept of price versus value is one that we have to engage more meaningfully on. And I think we've got some interesting sort of collaborations that we're working with, for example, with Vitality. Kids go free before 7 o'clock. The adults get a 50% discount. We have Half Price Tuesdays for our SK Club members. We have the Subs Club as well, which offers a bundled package. But at the moment, we're re-looking across the suite to try and dispel the myth between price and value. And I think, you know, watch the space for some interesting developments.
And I would imagine, finally, that you probably wake up in the early hours of the morning, Mark, and hope for another blockbuster, an Oppenheimer or a Barbie. That is what cinema ultimately is predicated on.
100%. Content is king. And to your point, you know, when the good stuff comes, people come back in their droves. You know, we've had a bit of franchise fatigue with Fast and Furious 10 and XYZ3 and all the rest. I think it is incumbent on Hollywood to go back to the drawing board in some respects and look at what brought people to cinema. But yes, Jeremy, from your lips to God's ears, between now and December, if you can lob in another Barbie and an Oppenheimer, I'd be deeply grateful.
All right, let me see what I can do. Mark Sardi, Chief Executive Officer of Stir Kinnicore, thank you very much for joining me today. And that also informs our online poll today. Do you think that cinema has a future? Very simply, yes, no, or I prefer Netflix. If you have a view on that, please go to MoneyWeb on Twitter X or on our LinkedIn page, and I will bring you the result on the Friday edition of the program. By the way, on our last online poll, we spoke about the Amazon Takealot battle. I asked if it was only about the price or if you'd go local or you'd wait and see. And our respondents saying while price is important, many respondents not rushing into that space just yet. MoneyWeb at midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.